I think we're now ready for our panel discussion. So we can have anybody in the audience ask a question to the panel, or I can continue to annoy them, whatever you'd prefer. Do we have some questions from the audience, please?
Question particularly for Dr. Evans and Dr. Goldstein. What possibilities do you see for this dialogue to include the end user or the ultimate consumer? A lot of it seemed to stem around, you know, us and the Gilman divide and so on, but a lot of what we're working towards are products for people.
So, sorry, you can't shut me up and give me a microphone. So I think there are two answers to that. So one is, if you're going to deal with a community of patients who are consumers of our ultimate work, you are immediately confronted with dealing with people in the community. And so the informed consent process is in part about educating people, and of course it's part about developing rapport with people so they are part of your community of patients in clinical trials. I think the second answer is that we can do quite a bit better in encouraging our scientists in particular to get out of their labs and into the public. Again, I think that message can come from the top in terms of how we value people's work. But again, my experience with my colleagues and my students is that when we give them opportunities to go into the public and talk at Rotary clubs, Lion clubs, with public groups of various sorts, they jump at the opportunity. And so it may be that the universe, I don't want us to invest in the Rotary Club game in particular, but it could be that by expanding these kinds of opportunities, we can tap this pool of young, enthusiastic scientists of all sorts of backgrounds to go into the community and talk about science and medicine and these issues.
That's a good example of the dimension I was talking about, which is to start from the social. As a general policy matter, we'd have to inquire of the entire collective, not the individual, to decide what the public generally wants in terms of policy. So, for example, when you have a clinical trial, you have to maximize autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Where did that come from? The Belmont Report. Where did that come from? While they were preparing the Belmont Report, they hired a bunch of sociologists to do a study of what the public thinks should be the values that we would represent in medicine. Then, once you've got a general policy, you have to interact with the individual, such as, do you actually want to sign this informed consent form, or do you actually want to be in this trial? So I think it's an example of the sort of merging between the two.
Well, this was actually to optimistically address that the question. One of the projects that a number of philosophers of science, people in ethics, interdisciplinary, that I'm part of, are pursuing is something, a project called Knowledge for Use. And one of the streams in that project is not looking at it from the point of view of informed consent, but when one is doing public health research and biomedical research, how can one ensure that the research is done in a way that takes cognizance and respects the experiences of the people for whom the research results are, whom the research results are intended to benefit? And this project involves things from HIV/AIDS policies in sub-Saharan Africa, and how do they take into account the experiences and demands of the and treat with respect, how does the research designed so that it treats with respect the people who are supposed to be beneficiaries? And that's a project that philosophers, interdisciplinary kind of project that we're already trying to engage in to figure out better institutional structures for the science, but particularly since I'm interested in social science, it's more of the public health and the basic biomedical research. But again, the research on neglected diseases and how to restructure or encourage different political, economic, legal structures to get research directed to things that matter to more widely in the public. Those are the kind of things, just the kind of things that go into the science studies program we have here and into a lot of the interdisciplinary projects that philosophers are already engaged in. So it's just the kind of thing we would hope to do in one of these new endeavors.
I really appreciate your panel presentations. Thank you. And I think it's really relatively easy to start thinking about how we can integrate ethics education into our day-to-day responsibilities. I think even when working with a graduate student who's doing a thesis or a dissertation, to ask them to consider what the ethical dimensions of this research is and to add an extra element into what they write about, to think through what the social responsibilities are and how what they're doing influences the public. And with regard to getting funding to do research on ethics in research, I've been able to stay funded for the past dozen years, specifically looking at how the ethical dimensions of research and how what are the factors that influence integrity of research in graduate education and specifically in community health. And how do our communities understand research and informed consent? And if you can get a consent form to pass the IRB's muster, is it really ethical when it comes into practice? And I'm on the IRB. I see them all the time. So I think we have a lot of things to think about, and I think it can be part of something that we all do every day. And I really do appreciate the interdisciplinary perspective, so thank you.
Please go ahead.
Okay. So thank you all. That was very enlightening. So I guess this is an invitation to say some more about how you see the collaboration and what sort of model you see. You know, it was actually really neat hearing Larry talk about his questions. These are some of the things that some of my colleagues teach. Is it morally permissible? What is the range of morally permissible genetic engineering that we can engage in? And these are sorts of questions we're thinking about on this side of Gilman Drive. So one model that just came to mind, this can give me a pitch about our law school too. So maybe USD isn't world class. I don't know how you measure these things, but the Law and Philosophy Institute is, and it's one of the things that that they do is have roundtables where they invite folks from all over the country who are doing the cutting edge work on the law side and on the philosophy side and bring them together, and it can be really a wonderful thing. So that's the kind of thing I could imagine being one part of the model, but it's really just an invitation to say more about how you see it.
So I've been on the faculty of this institution for 20 years, so it's getting on towards a long time. I'm getting old. And I think that this is an institution that, from where I sit, has done a great job of encouraging individual entrepreneurship and build up your own little thing. And we have good collaboration examples in some areas. My experience is that we're pretty good at building lots of small initiatives that don't necessarily talk to each other. And there are reasons why that might be a good thing to do as a general practice. But I think this is an occasion where it may really make sense to pick an area, make a good, thoughtful bet, and recruit in interdisciplinary positions in these stem cell and genomics, philosophy, ethics, and sociology and economic related topics, and not just always go for the best athlete no matter what they're doing, and then put incentives in place for these things to succeed. So,
can I just add to that? I mean, I think if you look at empirically in the United States, if you look at the universities that do this sort of thing, there is a fairly strong divide between typically institutions embedded inside of medical schools that pretty much just work on problems as defined by physicians and people doing experiments. And then there are institutions independent of medical schools that have sort of a disconnect from that. I'm thinking, the Hastings Center, which you could argue invented a certain type of bioethics back in the day, they would run screaming from most sort of clinical ethics sorts of questions. There are very few institutions that try to actually merge communication among all these parts. You know, and that's what I think of as the sort of the main unique UCSD possibility.
And the one question that I had, and also a comment, having seen, this is my second of these presentations, I was at the neuroscience creativity one, and then thinking about your presentation around CREATE, and this notion of what is happening with the undergraduates' direct experiences around learning about ethics, learning about the sciences. I know that we tend to give our students pretty sort of, if you're a STEM, you're doing this, if you're in social science, you're doing this, if you're in arts and humanities, you're doing this. But as we're thinking about these initiatives that are coming from all four of these sessions, is there a way to think, you know, at the 60,000 square foot level of what's the best construct in each of these to make sure all of our students are getting that experience so that you have a social science student who actually does have some background or understanding of ethics and the sciences. And so I was thinking about the work that you're doing in CREATE, but I was also thinking about the Bloom Project that we heard earlier about, where you see these really interesting, innovative kinds of connections that are happening among the people on campus. And then how do we make sure our undergraduate students are actually getting connected to that experience of the learning part of it. So when we're having these new institutes that become available, when we see these discussions and dialogues that are happening, when we're looking at using technology online, are we thinking about involving the actual students who will go out and develop these things going further? How are we positioning them in these areas that I keep seeing in the different research workshops? So I just wanted to bring that up because I've heard a lot of really good programs and processes, and a lot of you all talk about graduate students and undergraduate students that you're building into these initiatives. Is there a way for the initiatives themselves to be connected in some way and have an undergraduate be built around a kind of what do we want our undergraduates to understand across all these fields as well?
I was just going to say, if you're a student in a couple of the colleges, then you're automatically taking some courses that have bioethics. So these guys over there are teaching a lot of that. Which colleges are Warren? Warren runs 27 and 28, and then Six College does Cat 2. So there's a lot of that.
What are those words?
Those are courses. So the colleges have these mandatory courses, and so a lot of them are getting some of exposure there. And then philosophy is introducing or proposing this year a bioethics minor, which we hope will be popular because, I mean, we've got, you know, 40% of the majors are bio majors, some good chunk of whom are going into the health profession. And so hopefully, you know, they would see this as an opportunity. But I also think, you know, if any kind of big initiative like Larry is imagining happened, then I think there would, I mean, how could there not be some kind of fertilization down? You know, I mean, you would be bringing in more faculty who would be interested in that kind of thing. If they're going to teach, they might be interested in teaching that kind of thing. So I think it would help.
Well, this has been a great discussion, and let's thank everybody on our panel and the audience for good participation. Thank you.